WBZ presents an audition of Alden Hall Blackington in Yankee Yarns. Before we listen to Blackie's story tonight, let's pause for a brief moment and think of the voice which makes him clearly audible to those listening at home. The voice of WBZ's powerful transmitter. A dozen airline miles out in the harbor, it blankets metropolitan Boston with a signal of perfect clarity, leaping at the same instant to the far corners of all the New England states with velvet smoothness. For the moment, consider its daily impact on the 3 million people who live within 30 miles of the State House in Beacon Hill. In this area is 69% of the population of Massachusetts, over one-third of all the people in New England. All but an insignificant 3% of the homes here have radios, making it more radio-minded than any other section of the whole country. The heart of this rich market is Suffolk County, and its leading city is Boston, home of WBZ. And now, here's Blackie.
This is a story of pirate treasure. But unlike the stories of sea chests hidden deep in the sands of Cape Cod or Nova Scotia beyond the reach of treasure hunters, this cache of gold was found. The man who located it, through a genuine pirate's parchment map, is Mr. George F. Benner, former custodian of the Marine Museum in the Old State House at Boston. When Mr. Benner was a young lad, he used to spend his summer vacations in the little village of Middlesex, Vermont, some 6 or 7 miles above Montpelier. His uncle had a good-sized farm on the North Branch Road, and on rainy afternoons, his aunt Emmeline used to let him rummage around the attic, to his great delight. In the soft, warm darkness under the eaves, there was mystery and romance. Stacks of old magazines and books, old-fashioned flintlock guns and powder horns, a spinning wheel and sword, and the sweet-smelling yabs that hung from the rafters, and there was the trunk. The pirate's trunk that Aunt Emmeline said could never be opened because it didn't belong to her. Someday, perhaps, when you're older, George, I won't promise, but perhaps if you're a good boy, well, maybe I'm getting ahead of my story. Let's go back a bit. Emmeline Benner Lewis came from Maine. She was born in Waldeboro, not far from where my own grandmother was born, and she was a descendant of the seafaring Benners of Revolutionary fame. She died just a few years ago in Middlesex, Vermont, at the age of 102. One October night many years ago, when dusk was falling on the little town of Middlesex, and a raw, gusty wind was plucking at the shutters of the old Lewis farm, Mrs. Lewis lighted a big, fat kerosene lamp and placed it on the living room table by the window. As she drew the shades, big raindrops splashed on the pane, and she noticed, coming up the road, the strange figure of a man. She'd never seen anyone quite like him. He was leaning forward against the wind, and upon his stooped shoulders he held a good-sized trunk. He crossed the road and came toward the house. Mrs. Lewis was all alone. It would be hours before her husband would return from Montpelier. The next neighbors were some distance up the road, but she boldly opened the door and said, "Oh, my, do come in. It's so cold and windy." And then she had a good look at the stranger. If this had been Nantucket or Ellsworth or Point Judith, he would have seen part of the seascape. But up there in the Vermont hills, he was like an apparition. He was old, probably 80 or so, and thin, but he had broad shoulders, and the hand that held onto the brass-bound trunk was big and gnarled. But it wasn't these things that Mrs. Lewis noticed, nor his white hair and mustache and deep, piercing eyes under shaggy brows. It was the earrings, big as half dollars, that flashed in the flickering lamplight of her cozy kitchen. And that wasn't all. Around the man's waist was a faded and curiously folded sash. He was a sailor, all right, but what was he doing up there in Vermont? And what did he have in the leather-covered trunk that he'd put down beside the doorsteps? "You must be cold and hungry," she said warmly. "Thank you, ma'am, I am both." And the old man's face lighted up as Mrs. Lewis motioned him to a comfortable chair by the fireplace. "Now I'll poke up the fire and get you a bite to eat." When he had finished the meal and lighted his pipe, he sighed deeply. "I've come a long way up here to find an old shipmate of mine. We sailed together for years.
Singapore, Formosa, Madagascar, around the Horn, East and West Indies, slave trade, mutiny and all. 50 years, ma'am. Last I heard of him, he was living down here in the village. But nobody seems to know where he is. And his house is empty. I'm afraid he's dead. He tapped his pipe on the hearth and sighed again. With such a nor'east storm making up, I pushed on. If I could stay the night, ma'am, I'd be mighty grateful. Well, before the old fellow went to bed in the spare room, he fetched his trunk into the shed and with a polite bow said good night. Mrs. Lewis stayed up until her husband came home, and they agreed the old sailor should stay just as long as he wanted to. But next morning he was up bright and early, asking when the stage was due. And when he'd had a good breakfast, he pulled out a fat purse and laid down a dollar bill. Mrs. Lewis smiled. Why, we wouldn't think of charging you. Well, he said, I'd kind of like to ask another favor. Glancing toward the trunk, it's pretty heavy, ma'am, and I'm not as husky as I was once. Could I leave it for a week or so and pick it up when I come back? I'll gladly pay you. And just then the stage came clattering into the square, and the old man, earrings glittering in the sun, climbed aboard and was gone. The days stretched into weeks, weeks into months. 5 years went by, and not a sight or sound of the sailor. His brass-bound, leather-covered trunk was lugged into the attic under the eaves where the catnip hung. And there on warm afternoons, when the summer stillness was broken only by the far-off rumblings of thunder and the nearer chirpings of the robins crying for rain, young George Benner of Boston would sit and ponder over what was in that trunk and how he could get his Aunt Emmeline's permission to open it. Aunt Emmeline had a sister named Patience, who smoked an old clay pipe and told fortunes with a teacup. And one day, when her nephew was visiting the Vermont farm, she whirled his teacup around and said excitedly, Georgie, I see a fortune coming to you through a paper. It looks like a map or something. And I see pirate gold, lots of it. Well, that boy was so excited he couldn't sleep that night, thinking about the pirate's trunk up in the attic, filled in all probability with doubloons and sovereigns and diamonds and jade from far-off places. And the next day he pleaded with his Aunt Emmeline to open the trunk that had, for over 20 years now, reposed among the cobwebs under the eaves. Finally, just to keep him quiet, she said, when you're 18, George, if the trunk is still here, and no word has come from the old man, who would have been well over 100, I'll let you open it, but I'm afraid you'll be disappointed. In the years that followed, Benner was a busy young man. And when World War I broke out, he was even busier helping Uncle Sam. And it wasn't until after that war that he went back to the old farm in Vermont. His uncle had died, and so had Aunt Patience. But Aunt Emmeline was there, and so was the trunk. But somehow, with the passing of time and the war and all, it had lost its magic. Or was it just because the boy was now a man? It so happened that there was another George visiting in Middlesex, Vermont, a fellow from Maine. And the two Georges often went fishing together. One day, George Benner told his friend about the old sailor's trunk, and they decided to open it. So the next day, Aunt Emmeline led the way up the stairs to the attic, and they dragged out the old trunk. I wouldn't let you touch it, she said, but that old man said he didn't have a relative in the world, and I know he must be dead by now. So go ahead and cut the straps. A single hammer blow split the lock, and with a creak of rusty hinges and a puff of musty dust, up came the cover, revealing a mass of old, moth-eaten clothes. And under the faded coat, there was a carved whale's tooth, an old broken quadrant, some seashells, and a badly stained copy of Scott's Pirate. George Benner picked up the mildewed volume and opened it callously. Opened it to a folded piece of vellum such as pirates used to make maps on. His heart beat fast, and when he unfolded it, he was too excited to talk. For there was a map of the Maine coast near the Kennebec River, with a star marking a small bay. And under it was written with very poor writing and horrible spelling the following paragraph. Stand abreast Quartz Boulder. Bring top in line with hill. North 1/2 mile it lies, 12 fathoms. Northeast, near big trees, under stone. Well, a few days later, two very excited young men took the boat to Bath, Maine, where they hired a motorboat and loaded it with provisions. They took a compass, spades and picks, and several bags to put the treasure in. But there were hundreds of bays and inlets looking more or less alike on that part of the Maine coast. So all day they sailed back and forth, scanning the shore for the quartz boulder and the clump of tall trees. The October sun was dropping behind the flaming oaks and maples, and long shadows were stealing across the calm water when suddenly George Benner shouted, "Look over there! Look at that big rock!" And sure enough, about 40 feet above the waterline, a big boulder caught the sunlight and sparkled brilliantly. "And see that tree, George? It's just where the clump of trees is on the map." The sun had gone down now, and it was getting cold. So they went ashore and made camp, not daring to leave the spot they'd found. But long before sunrise, they were up, and after a quick turn around the cove, they located the spot indicated on the map. 2 hours later, they found the flat stone, and with crowbars and round sticks, they rolled it a few inches to one side and dug feverishly into the sandy soil. 2 feet down, their shovel struck another rock. They scooped away the earth, pried the stone loose, and dug deeper. Few treasure hunters have been so rewarded, for among the pebbles and dirt there were fragments of rotted wood, a piece of rusted metal, and part of a barrel head. Mr. Benner shoved his hands into the crumbling earth, and his fist closed on a hard, round object, black with age. He scraped it against the edge of his shovel and saw the glint of gold under the grime. "Why," he said, "there must be thousands of them here. Get the bags, quick." And without stopping to examine what they'd found, they dumped handful after handful into the canvas bags. They were reaching deep into the hole to get the last of the coins embedded in the rotted wood when they heard voices on the hill above them. 2 men were coming along the shore toward the cove. So they hustled the bags aboard the motorboat and shoved off. But they were afraid to land in Bath, and they sailed on to Gloucester and spent the night there, sleeping on top of their treasure. Late the next afternoon, their little motorboat nosed into Boston Harbor and tied up at the wharf on Northern Avenue. Mr. Benner went ashore and telephoned a Boston bank, and in no time a car came down to the wharf and the bags were safe inside. Once behind locked doors, with the coins spread out on newspapers, the treasure hunters all but collapsed. They hadn't realized what a strain they'd been under. In describing this treasure to Carl Wotton of the Boston Sunday Herald, Mr. Benner said they received about $20,000 for the lot, dividing it equally. He will never, as long as he lives, forget the thrill of running his fingers through those black, heavy doubloons and pillar dollars of the 17th century. And among them was a package containing a beautiful pearl necklace and a 9-inch golden cross all studded with gems. They always intended to go back to that spot on the main coast to search further, but they never did. If you have in your attic an old trunk or chest or box left behind by some pirate, call me up. There's nothing I'd rather do than go digging for buried treasure.
Thank you, Blackie. In designing this program for you, we've had in mind the type of evening entertainment which will attract the favorable notice of the largest portion of WBZ's audience. Another important consideration must inevitably be the potentiality of this audience in buying power. Taking the metropolitan Boston portion of our listeners only, it is of note that its purchasers have recorded the highest per capita number of retail transactions in the United States. Ranking as the 9th largest city in America, it holds 5th place as a manufacturing center and in retail volume. Strategically situated on the global air map of commercial travel, its airport is now being stepped up to the size needed to compete with that of any other city. WBZ, therefore, serves an audience of prime interest to anyone desirous of merchandising in this, our great nation. And we believe, too, that WBZ listeners are the most likely to be interested in the type of program which brings them Stories of New England by Alton Hall Blackington.